The Resurrection of Conscience. While our founder struck a balance between high ideals and politics, the last generation of Americans to create such a balance and then lose it was the generation that came of age in the 1960s. When I was growing up, the hipper you were, the more politically progressive your vision tended to be. But not anymore. Our newest breed of hip and cool seems so tied to the money-making possibilities of America, so jaded at the thought of idealism, that they're often the first to roll their eyes when you mention something like, 36 million Americans live in poverty. Shouldn't we do something? Oh, please, younger ones respond as though everybody knows that there's nothing we could do even if we wanted to. Or, oh, please, older ones respond, bored. Haven't we all gotten past that by now? As though a sense of moral outrage is something you try out in college, then outgrow. Still, I don't think that the last generation to devote real political capital to the cause of social justice actually outgrew its conscience or consciously closed its heart. I believe that what happened is that we, like the young son of Robert Kennedy, who watched his father assassinated on television, have been traumatized and in shell shock ever since the 60s. Our heroes were shot in front of us, and our dreams, which they articulated for us, have seemed to lie dead in their graves. The marriage of body and soul. In the 1960s, love and politics were uttered in the same breath. All You Need Is Love was a song that we sang at political rallies. Such slogans helped fuel the anti-war movement, certainly a major political force at the time and ultimately a successful one. But by the mid-1970s, love and politics took different paths. Many who stayed interested in politics would come to trivialize the consciousness movement, and many of those interested in consciousness would start to ignore politics. Both sides tended to smugly, self-righteously dismiss the other as ultimately irrelevant, thinking that they and they alone knew what it takes to change the world. To fundamentally change America, we must be equally committed to our spiritual and our political goals. We must reconnect the earth and sky and blend again the two realms of our being. A combination of body and soul infuses both with greater importance. The combination of spirituality and politics is, in fact, a distinctly American philosophical throughline, and the value of their marriage is as applicable to the world today as it was to any other time. Transcendent power. The thought that spiritual power can transform social and political conditions is nothing new. Indeed, it is a well-established political tradition. From the Quakers of early America to Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr., there have been those who used spiritual principle to foster outer as well as inner change. Transcendental power, with its emphasis on internal rather than external religious experience, has deep and penetrating roots in American history. The Quakers, who founded Pennsylvania, are an example of people who place spiritual experience above religious dogma. As historian Daniel Boorstin wrote in his book, Landmark History of the American People, just as the Puritans were enthusiastic pessimists, so the Quakers were fanatics about their consciences. Keep looking inward, they said. Let your conscience be your guide. They were afraid of any scheme that was cut and dried, even if some people thought it came from God himself. God, they said, did not really communicate with man from any printed page. He spoke to each man from within, brightening each man with an inner light. During the 1800s, Transcendentalism, which was inspired by the Quaker notion of inner light, became an important philosophical and spiritual movement in America. Its main thrust was the exaltation of the role of intuition in connecting the individual to ultimate truth. Major American writers, from Ralph Waldo Emerson to Henry David Thoreau to Walt Whitman, devised and embraced transcendental philosophy. They formed a counterforce to the materialistic worldview of the approaching industrial era, seeking to preserve the power of the soul in the consciousness of Western humanity. In his essay, Civil Disobedience, Thoreau claimed that following the dictates of one's conscience is more important than following the dictates of a government. At the time, such a philosophical assertion was groundbreaking, with the prosecution of Nazi war criminals on those grounds at the Nuremberg trials following World War II, the Western world solidified its adherence to the notion of the primacy of conscience. In India in 1929, Mahatma Gandhi had written to a friend of the deep impression that Thoreau's essay had left on him. Inspired in part by Thoreau's message, Gandhi organized a massive resistance to the British colonial occupation of India, developing an entire political philosophy, the philosophy of nonviolence, to harness the energies of the Indian people. Gandhi was the first major figure of the modern era to introduce into politics the power of spiritual wisdom. The restoration of India's independence was secondary to Gandhi. What he wanted most was the restoration of India's soul. The British rejection of and contempt for the Indian people, much like white European treatment of Native Americans and Africans in the United States, resulted from a terrible dissociation of the Westerner from the most vital elements within himself. Having turned away from his own soul, the European grew vicious in the face of those who preserved and lived from theirs. Gandhi said that he would have the greatest effect on the world by trying to reduce himself to zero. He gave this counsel to others. I will give you a talisman. Whenever you are in doubt, or when the self becomes too much with you, apply the following test. Recall the face of the poorest and the weakest man whom you may have seen, and ask yourself if the step you contemplate taking is going to be of any use to him. Will he gain anything by it? Will it restore him to control over his own life and destiny? Will it lead to deliverance for the hungry and starving millions? Then you will find your doubt and yourself melting away. Gandhi believed the soul has the power to restore society. As Gandhi was influenced by Thoreau, Martin Luther King Jr. would then be influenced by Gandhi. He believed, as Gandhi did, that only the universal awakening of conscience could cast out institutionalized systems of injustice. Dr. King, traveling to India, said this about Gandhi. He was probably the first person in history to lift the love ethic of Jesus above mere interaction between individuals to a powerful, effective social force on a large scale. Gandhi argued the notion, and both men displayed it, that soul force is more powerful than brute force. Dr. King and Gandhi believed in a God who concerns himself with the problems of the world, and they believed his power is a spirit we can personally access. The Quakers sought to experience this power, the Transcendentalists sought to exalt it, and Gandhi and Dr. King both sought to use it to heal a broken world. The power of nonviolence. The power of nonviolence is the love of God expressed through human beings. It results from human dedication to love and devotion to the effort to remove all fear and hatred from our hearts. Nonviolence lifts human consciousness to realms of divine authority, providing spiritual power to our words and deeds. The powers of the world are often contemptuous of the powers of spirit, but the meek shall inherit the earth because their ways are more fit for ultimate survival. The meek display a gentleness more adaptive to change than is an attitude of harsh resistance. This gentleness is not weakness, but strength. Both Gandhi and Dr. King believed that the purest, ultimately most powerful form of struggle against social injustice is to awaken the conscience of the oppressor. Are you prepared to go to jail? King asked his followers. Are you prepared to be beaten without fighting back? If they were not, he said, then they were not prepared to take part in his nonviolent crusade for civil rights. The political strategy of the movement was to awaken the conscience of America, and that would not happen, King knew, if white America saw African Americans reacting violently to their oppressors. Crusaders for civil rights, like all those who seek to usher in new orders, suffered great humiliation at the hands of the defenders of the status quo. But faith brings forth divine compensation. There is, Dr. King claimed, a redemptive power in unearned suffering. Love does not always immediately triumph. It does, however, always ultimately triumph. That is the message of the resurrection, echoed in various ways by every great religious system. Goodness, claimed King, would prevail over the hatred and bigotry lodged in men's hearts. Thus his prophetic vision, we shall overcome. Only with the removal of hatred is the soul restored to its triumphant power. With hatred, we can resist the ways of the world, but with love, we can overcome the world. Love endureth. Since King's death, nonviolence as a serious political option in America has been all but dead as well. King's death remains an inestimable loss for America and the world. He presumably would not have stopped his message at civil rights, just as he was already doing in speaking out against the Vietnam War. It is reasonable to assume he would have continued his crusade for heaven on earth with a passionate strike against injustice wherever he perceived it. There are many today who would call nonviolence a defunct political philosophy. But nonviolence is not just a political philosophy, it is a philosophical truth. It lives outside of time in the realm of absolutes. Truth can never be defunct, but merely unexpressed. If nonviolence is an ineffective political force today, it is only because it is not being used. The only real death is an unaware mind. If we ignore the laws of love and the reality of spirit, then we are dead although we live. If we remember and demonstrate the spiritual authority brought into the world through the likes of Dr. King and Gandhi, then they remain alive although they are dead. Any human being can be a womb for the rebirth of the spirit of nonviolence. Death can make love stumble, but it cannot make it die. That was then, this is now. And what is our task in these still unjust, yet infinitely more complicated times? Although it can hardly be argued that the challenge before us is harder than those before Dr. King and Gandhi, it could indeed be argued that our work is less simple and clear-cut. Evil wears business suits in the world today, hiding behind pinstripes, smiling away. Today's darkness is like an inoperable tumor, a hidden cancer. It's always lurking behind this or that, or like a spider tumor, sort of everywhere. There's cancer underlying our cancers. It is spiritual and systemic. It cannot be treated effectively through any traditional means. Our disease is a web of falsehoods. A big lie meanders somewhere near the center of things in America like a slow-acting poison. From illegal CIA interference in the domestic politics of other nations, to the democracy-threatening influence of big money on the electoral process, to increased secrecy in our military and intelligence agencies and economic injustice, it reveals itself in sickening ways. People feel it on the left and on the right. Polls indicate that Americans feel good about their lives, but cynical about the country. It feels like light is pouring through us as individuals, but some darkness infests the nation. Today's darkness is a negative darkness. It is not an active, aggressive, evil force, so much as a vast spiritual emptiness, the nothingness of which has formed a black hole in the consciousness of the human race. The worst danger is not that a room full of people are trying to figure out how to destroy the world, but that not enough people are trying to figure out how to heal it. We're so consumed with consumerism that we're on the brink of being consumed. We have allowed ourselves in the last 50 years to become intoxicated by money at the expense of things that matter most. As a society, we have made money our bottom line, when our bottom line should be love. We are in a collective backslide of conscience. A terrible economic injustice has set in as a result, leaving millions of lives displaced or ruined by our collective willingness to make human life less important than the dollar. This is not a problem that applies to the consciousness of the average American. The American people know and act like money isn't everything, but our collective behavior and social policies do not reflect that knowing. The next step in America's progress is to reclaim the public sphere for what is best about America. We are brought to this earth for something much more important than feeding a gargantuan money machine at the expense of our children and the expense of our souls. America's mission. America has always been a land of pioneers, not just geographically, but also ideally. The American ideal is like a mark on our foreheads. It is emblazoned onto our national psyche that this is a land that should seek remedy to institutionalized oppression. What history has proved, of course, is that some of humanity's worst afflictions have emanated from America. From our treatment of Native Americans to our practice of slavery and systemic racism, yet this has not changed our mission or our destiny. It has increased our pain to know that we are as capable as anyone else of atrocities directed toward others of our species. Yet it is in our shame as well as our well-deserved pride that we are prodded by something larger than ourselves to become a nation that helps enlighten the world. Now, although it is the 11th hour and our streets are riddled with social cancers, there is a stirring that says to this nation, return to your purpose. As we consciously return to our enlightened collective purpose, the unenlightened energies that surround us will now begin to wane. We don't need to fight the darkness so much as we need to turn on the light. It is our nature and our destiny to pioneer new ground. What we must pioneer now is an effort that we ourselves have been running from, the search for oneness of mind and heart. Our challenge is to speak up for heart with heart. The greatest contribution a liberal can make to a political renaissance in America is to surrender his or her contempt for a conservative viewpoint, just as the greatest contribution a conservative can make is to surrender his or her contempt for a liberal viewpoint. judgment undercuts our personal power, diminishing our capacity for insight and destroying the emotional connection without which true communication is impossible. Gandhi said, "We must be the change." This does not mean that we must become enlightened masters before we can have a positive effect on the world. It means, however, that our every effort to live lives of righteousness and purity as we understand it is supported by the power of God. It is in forgiving people that we release them from the darkness we might judge them for. It is in refusing to judge people that we have the most power to affect them. And it is in loving people that we heal them of the wounds that have hardened their minds and hearts. That is why a new politics is one in which our own whole person must be the world we work on first. Our meditations, our personal growth work, our prayers, our healing, and our need to forgive and withhold judgment are the things we must concentrate on first in seeking to transform the world. Otherwise, we remain stuck in a Newtonian paradigm, keeping ourselves separate from the thing we wish to change and therefore unable to do so. There are those who believe that where there is no anger at something, there is no motivation to change it. But violence only leads to violence. Anger, like money and white sugar, is a temporary motivator of lower human energies. It is love that calls up the divine within us and love that gives us divinely inspired power. The moral debate. Any society, if it is to survive and thrive, must have a moral anchor. American conservatives are correct to insist on this. In direct opposition to some of its own most shining lights, the American left has, in the last 30 years, abdicated the moral debate to the other side of the political spectrum. But ethical questioning is a domain that belongs to all of us and that rightly belongs in politics. Leaving the ethical debate to the private domain deprives society of collective meaning. Our diversity, both cultural and religious, must have an underlying unity, and common ethical assumptions are part of it. We must have common spaces, common experiences, and common conversations. Without those things, we become one nation in name only. Charisma is not a bad thing. The word literally means of the spirit. Progressive politics lacks charisma today because it is literally dispirited. It does not even know how to say to America that we must address the extreme disparity between rich and poor, not just because it is financially unsustainable, which it is, and not just because it limits our freedom, which it does, but because it is morally wrong. Black Americans have never severed the bond between a genuinely religious consciousness and left-wing politics, but white liberals have basically torn the two asunder. The last great white liberal in America to couch political issues in moral terms was Robert F. Kennedy, and it is not an accident that he was the last American liberal to truly own a piece of America's heart. Not dead, merely sleeping. The generation that lost the Kennedys and King has never totally gotten over it. The invisible order that shot our heroes did not keep shooting, but began providing goods and services as quickly as possible to distract a grieving generation from our psychic pain. They did not leave us out of their conception of what America should be. Quite to the contrary, they used us as their fodder, luring us into their planned environment of endless material consumption. We have been relatively quiet about anything meaningful ever since. Our leaders assassinated, our ranks dispersed, our generation received instructions, "Go home now, scatter, go to your rooms and enjoy yourselves with all the toys we sell you." Because the 60s generation was not well versed in its historical past, we believed that the loss of our hero's vision was a loss for all time. We were not aware enough of the rhythms of history, of the myth of the eternal return, of the cyclical nature of humanity's march through time. In pain, we turned away from politics, abdicating the field to those who wanted it in the first place. Are we free? Of course we're free. We can buy the red one, or we can buy the blue one. We have countenanced the undermining of our political system. We have tolerated the widening gap between rich and poor in America to levels deemed unsustainable by serious economic indicators. We have sold the health and welfare of our children and our environment to the highest bidders. The baby boom generation has huge size and potency. Our woundings are as a logjam beyond which the river of American genius can flow but in a trickle compared to its potential. Yet all generations now converge at a watershed moment. While the 60s fervor for the creation of a better world was shot down like a bird from the skies above us, it has been 30 years since that time. Historian Arthur Schlesinger has pointed out that Americans become involved in politics every 30 years. No political power can bring the dead back to life. Only spiritual power can do that. Resurrection is not of the body, but of the mind. We so mourned the passing of great personalities who were taken from us that we mistakenly believed their principles died with them. But that is only true if those principles pass from our minds. The highest possibilities for American democracy are never dead. They merely fall asleep sometimes. They are a permanent part of our potential as a nation, as long as even one of us remembers them. It is time for us to remember that an essential part of ourselves now sleeping will awaken before it is too late. If love came first. In business, for the most part, there is an inherent motivation to serve people. In government, owing to the extraordinary and pernicious influence of money on the electoral process, this is no longer necessarily true. The interests of the people are often secondary to the interests of major political contributors. Those who see economics as the defining issue of our vital interests aren't always looking for the loving solution to domestic or international problems. If love came first, we would use our financial resources to create jobs to help people live well, instead of building more prisons to punish them when they do not. If love came first, we would value human rights at least as much as economic rights. If love came first, we would seek to educate and help rather than to prosecute our children violently screaming out for attention. It is a sociological truism that any old guard system sees the coming order as unrealistic. It is true that the political order in power now sees too much love talk as rather silly. But I have watched these people as they make their decisions and heard them as they talk about their plans. The guys in suits who run the world are as emotionally vulnerable in their own way as anyone else. They just as easily could consider the world from an expansive, open-hearted consciousness, but they do not do it for three basic reasons. First, most of them actually do not know how. They have been trained to think along authoritarian, patriarchal thought patterns, and that's the box they're stuck in. Second, they fear mockery by the mainstream press and cultural gatekeepers if they were to appear too soft. Third, they seem to think the public isn't looking, isn't thinking, doesn't deeply care anymore about social justice. You suggest that maybe they could remind the people of such an important thing, you know, lead, and they look at you with empty eyes. The leader with conscience must be willing to risk repudiation. The person with conscience has a responsibility to be a thorn in the side of a complacent status quo. The person with conscience holds up a mirror to the world, which must include himself. The person with conscience is an agent of awakening in a world where there is a collective urge to sleep. Why should news programs have daily reports on how Wall Street is doing, but not on how our children are doing? Why are we to be more concerned as a society? If the stock market is depressed, then if our people are depressed, and who is going to change the conversation and our bottom line, if not us? It is true that in many environments, to bring up the unnecessary suffering of millions and the policies that perpetuate that suffering might get you quickly slapped with the label of bleeding heart, but there's an answer to that. Be slapped and take heart. All you need is one person in the room to say, actually, I agree with that. And we're starting to act like participants in broad-based social change. I do not believe that the average American would ever want to see a child living under oppressive and cruel conditions. I believe the average American does not realize how many millions of children in America today are literally dying beneath the yoke of our current social policies. If enough of us embrace the spirit of nonviolence and adopt a personal commitment to conscience, making whatever each of us can to increase the power of good in this world, then we will achieve at this time of millennial shift as stunning a leap forward in human consciousness and world affairs as any generation has ever made. There is a door that we can open together, on the other side of which is a shining new world. Emerald City. To place money before love is idolatry. That is true for an individual, and it is true for a nation. A nation of idol worshippers always has been, and always will be, struck down. There can be no serious healing of America without looking deeply at the ways in which money runs this country, any more than there can be any serious healing of a wound without treating it. It leads us into areas that are neither fun nor uplifting to consider. Until we do, however, we cannot be true healers of this nation. I used to think that maybe the rich knew something I didn't know, that maybe they considered the collective good of the nation in ways I didn't understand. But when I made some money, what I found out is the following. There are glamorous rituals you go through once your bank account reaches a certain level. You're ushered into very nice offices, given lots of coffee or tea or Evian water and crystal glasses, treated very nicely by people who are just as aware as you are that we're at a party that can't go on forever but wouldn't dare say so at the office, then given the message in various ways that the point of all your money is, number one, to buy a nice house, and number two, to protect your investments. It could work another way. Once we have a certain amount of money, we could go through a ritual in which we commit within our hearts to do everything we can with our newfound material power to ensure that those who do not have it yet might have the same opportunities to make it that we had. We could discuss that over crystal glasses. We could feel, as affluent people, that we carry a sacred responsibility to increase the good of our country and our world. This kind of thinking wouldn't decrease our wealth. It would increase it many times over, for it is thinking that carries spiritual power. There are millions of people in America, rich and poor, who are more than ready to participate in a collective commitment to an ever-increasing societal good. But such an effort doesn't currently exist as a dominant social force, a sense of national purpose. We are rediscovering the importance of individual communities, but the nation itself should be a community as well. Helping each other should not be seen as a radical fringe idea. Corporate soul. The forces that drive the U.S. economy are drunk on power. They swagger, they deny, they justify, they intimidate. That's what drunks do. The American people must stop wimping out and awaken from our codependent stupor. We should perform the political equivalent of an intervention. Many people are doing extremely important work transforming the ethos of the American corporation. Just beneath the surface, American business today runs on two separate tracks, one of expanding heart and one of expanding greed. Are ethics more important than money, or is money more important than ethics? When business factors in the costs necessary to earn a profit, those costs should include costs to our environment and costs to human life and health and values. The slash-and-burn mentality that permeates much of corporate America today and the government's greater commitment to serve the market rather than protect people from its excesses are at the heart of America's pain. The top 5% of our population takes home half the nation's income. Huge and profitable companies lay off thousands of employees for no other reason than to increase their short-term stock prices and their already outrageous executive compensation packages. Congress grants huge subsidies and tax breaks amounting to billions of dollars in corporate welfare, and the health and safety of the average American are increasingly crushed underneath it all. Even our national security is threatened by our slavish devotion to the market. In 1995, for instance, we deregulated the sale of supercomputers to the Chinese, a move that could dangerously increase their nuclear capacity. They've been buying them up ever since. U.S. officials have said they believe that civilian purchasers in China are making sure the equipment is not diverted to military uses, but this opinion is based on no hard evidence. Government sources admit that they received the majority of their data from the computer companies. We have attached our foreign policy to commerce to such an extent that human values, even the security of our future, have become secondary considerations. The influence of money on the political process is a fast-growing cancer in America. It grows in small ways and big ways every day of the year. The average American citizen should understand how it operates. There is an old French saying, "If you don't do politics, politics will do you." According to a May 17, 1997 New York Times article entitled "Corporate Gifts Open Door to Governor's Inner Sanctum," a select group of 100 companies, among them Exxon, General Motors, and Philip Morris, have given millions of tax-deductible dollars to the National Governors Association in the past several years in exchange for intimate access to legislation that affects their business. For an annual membership of $12,000, a corporation can designate one or more of its employees to be members of the Center for Best Practices, a nonprofit branch of the Governors Association that researches social and economic policies. According to the association's fact sheet, the so-called corporate fellows attend meetings, briefings, and are even offered private offices. The corporations are courted by the Governors Association as a resource to obtain the best information on the issues they legislate. However, because no labor organizations, policy advocacy, or interest groups are invited to join, the plan clearly paves the way for the undue influence of big business on our government. During a forum held to discuss electricity policy, environmental regulation by the federal government, and pending legislation on the cleanup of toxic waste dumps, Gregory Whetstone, the legislative director of the Natural Resources Defense Council, found himself head-to-head not only with the governors and state environmental officials, but with lobbyists from the corporations that are members of the Center for Best Practices and opponents of tighter governmental standards. Speaking to the New York Times, Mr. Whetstone said, "It is very troubling that corporations are able to buy a much greater level of access than the public in general or the public interest community. So much for our founders' dream of disinterested leadership." Corporations of themselves are not the problem, but only their undue influence. We don't want to turn off the system. There's nothing beautiful about what happens in a society where money stops circulating. Our challenge is not to destroy capitalism, but to transform its dominant ethos, not to childishly and blindly demonize the corporation, but to make a case for the importance and ultimate benefit to all of conscience within it. The notion of a corporation existing for no other purpose than to increase the financial good of its shareholders without thought of responsibility to workers or communities must change and is changing, but it is not changing fast enough. We need a quantum shift. We must do more than rally to serve all of America's underprivileged citizens. We must ask ourselves, what is wrong with our society, including our public policies, that there are so many people living in desperate conditions to begin with? People act as though caring is enough. I call it the "I really care, therefore I don't have to do anything" syndrome. Many people said after President Clinton's first election, "I finally feel we have a president who cares." But this poses an interesting moral question to our generation. If someone cares and they hurt you, do they get more or fewer points in heaven than the person who doesn't care and hurts you? Does the feeling of compassion itself count as a moral good, or must the feeling be expressed through action? And if we do nothing to stop injustice, does that not mean that we tacitly support it? Caring and feeling are important, but they come relatively cheap. We live in a culture that exalts the verbal expression of compassion, but often resists compassionate action. We use a syrupy concern for one hurt child or one lost soldier to mask the fact that life in America is hell for millions of others. The devil often poses as a family kind of guy. American children are 12 times more likely to die of gun violence than any other Western nation, 5 times more likely to be murdered, and twice as likely to commit suicide. If we're interested in family values, we will radically recommit to making the society safe for children, and we will stop creating red herrings to obfuscate the fact that we consistently protect business interests at the expense of our children's lives. The people who are the most devoted to funneling public money away from children and policies which protect them often do the most public relations work to show us how much they love their kids. That nails the issue. No one is doubting that they love their kids, but the exclusive love of our children, or even some children, is not the love that will save the world. The children that matter now are the children on the other side of town. The moral and political shift that America most needs now is a switch from an exclusive to an inclusive sense of family and love. American children are critically threatened with an array of forces stemming directly and indirectly from our societal neglect and injustice, inadequate health and environmental standards, lack of education, lack of health care and job training, and massive unemployment in the inner cities. Upon mentioning our responsibility to help millions of American children who wake up each day and go to sleep each night in literally life-threatening conditions, we're liable to be met with a line, "But how are you going to pay for it?" When George Bush told us Kuwait was threatened, no one asked him that. Surely the problems of American children are much closer to home than Kuwait is. What we lack is not money, but political will. It is a lie, a big lie, to claim budget restraints as a reason for not investing in the potential genius of each and every American. It is not the constraints on our budget, but the constraints on our minds and the constraints on our hearts that limit America now. Economics, schmeconomics. One of the 20th century wizards of Oz, he was a fraud, you remember, he cannot take you home, is the so-called science of economics. Economist Hazel Henderson has written, "Economics is now revealed as a 300-year-old grab bag of unverifiable propositions too vague to be refuted. Economists are like a group of people who came out of nowhere and all of a sudden run the world. Who made them boss? Economists do not normally include in their calculations such spiritual precepts as the golden rule. But everything that goes around comes around. The universe is based on the law of cause and effect, and that is as true for a nation as an individual. Love is as serious a subject, as difficult a subject, and as sophisticated a subject as money. Why should we treat economics more seriously than love? This makes no sense, and anyone with the slightest understanding of the metaphysics of money knows that ultimately it actually stops the flow of money creation. God is love, and love is the only abundance. Everything else is just the toys we've been playing with at an immature level of our spiritual development. From a spiritual perspective, no nation as wealthy as ours, with as many underprivileged children as we have, has any basis for long-term economic optimism whatsoever. I'll tighten my belt when you tighten yours. The leaders of Congress are very big these days on telling us that we're going to have to make very difficult decisions in order to balance the federal budget. What they seem unwilling to cut, however, is the unbelievable system of corporate welfare by which the taxpayers of the United States subsidize the country's wealthiest companies. According to Common Cause, the progressive public interest advocacy group, corporate welfare will cost us $265 billion over the next 5 years. We subsidize private California wineries, oil companies, timber and forest companies, the broadcasting industry, and others. We even gave McDonald's $1.6 million to help them advertise fast food products overseas and $78 million since 1986 to Sunkist so they could promote their oranges in Asia. With the latest tax bill, we've agreed to pay $4 billion over the next 10 years to subsidize ethanol, a gasoline substitute produced by Archer Daniels Midland. Last year, that company gave more than $1 million in political contributions to Democrats and Republicans. All of our subsidized industries, of course, are major election campaign contributors. That's the way the system works. In the summer of 1997, the Senate began major hearings regarding foreign contributions to American election campaigns. This is a perfect way to deflect attention from the purely legal contributions to political campaigns made by companies right here in the USA, according to a system that has deeply corrupted our political process, but that neither major party has yet made a meaningful effort to change. And yet, we are told that we just don't have the money to provide more educational and job opportunities or health care benefits to average American citizens. In President Clinton's 1997 budget, he proposed $5 billion be provided as seed money to help repair and upgrade decrepit public schools. The Republicans cut the amount to zero. Neither side, however, was actually standing up tall to get the job done. According to government studies, it would actually take $112 billion to bring America's schools up to minimum building standards. Notice that we're not discussing new educational programs that would help America's children reach anywhere near their full human potential. That seems to remain way beyond our current level of political consciousness. What we're talking about here is whether the richest nation in the world is committed to its children going to schools whose buildings satisfy minimum safety requirements, meet basic construction standards, and have adequate heating, not to mention even working toilets. And all those computers for the schools we're committed to hooking up on the internet? Well, that won't be happening in America's poorest schools because they don't have adequate wiring for computers, even if computers were provided. Why? Because we just don't have the money. They do. Whenever someone suggests a program to aid our children, support education, or rebuild our most devastated communities, they're liable to be criticized as supporting big government programs as solutions to society's ills. This argument is an example of what happens when public relations slogans begin to replace thinking. The biggest lies repeated enough times start to sound true. There are huge government programs we should be worried about, don't get me wrong. The Pentagon is a big government program that receives $259 billion annually. Education, job training, employment, community development, health and social services, however, all combined, receive $59 billion a year less than what we give to the military. What's the answer? Better questions. Tra-la-la-la-la. To prison we all go. Nowhere is our current government thinking more obsolete or more corrupt than in the area of crime and punishment. This issue is crucially related to other areas of public policy and poses a huge threat to the health and safety of American society. Violence is to love as darkness is to light. It is what happens in the absence of something else. Hitting it, fighting it, and suppressing it are merely temporary palliatives. If we want peaceful teens, we must ourselves, as a society, show peace and love toward our younger children. There will be no dealing effectively with crime until we decide as a society to massively invest in the care of our very young children. A child's major behavioral tendencies are set by the time he or she is 10 years old. No amount of boot camp, midnight basketball, or tough prison sentencing can do a whole lot to change that. If a gang has created more sense of social belonging in a child's life than we have, guess what? We lost that one. We need to shift our emphasis away from punishment or even prevention as an answer to crime. We should turn our attention to actual cause. 95% of all prison inmates in this country are high school dropouts. Many, if not most of them, are functionally illiterate. It's easy to blame our juvenile crime problem on absentee parents and drugs, but outrageously inadequate schooling and child social services don't help. They exacerbate the problem, making all of us accomplices in the criminal neglect of our nation's children. America gets what it pays for. We invest our money in our military, and we have a fine military. We invest our money in businesses, and they thrive. But our children, why should we not invest massively in them? Money for health care, money for child care, for quality of life, for education. For $1.5 billion, the price of one B-2 bomber, which we're building, although the Pentagon doesn't even want it, we could pay for the annual salaries of over 56,000 new elementary school teachers or 125,000 child care workers. While it is true that spirituality, not money, is the ultimate answer to our problems, who can be gentle and loving for long around hundreds of angry, frustrated children? It takes money to create the environments conducive to the flowering of human capacity. If we would spend a fraction of the money we now spend dealing with criminals on the children of the United States, we would have a much more peaceful society at a lot less cost to the American taxpayer. While there are brilliant, dedicated individuals working within our criminal justice system, attitudes which are beginning to dominate that system are barbaric. American society breeds hundreds of thousands of criminals and then says to law enforcement, "Here, you handle it." We treat our prisons like garbage dumps to receive society's refuse. What is going on behind bars in the United States today should be of serious concern to all of us. Brutality throughout this system is epidemic. And now there is a drive, particularly on the federal level, to put more juveniles in jail with the adult prison population. The potential for human tragedy here is enormous. A 16-year-old schoolboy in Texas named Rodney Hewlin Jr. was charged with arson in 1995 in a fire that did $500 damage to a fence. He admitted his guilt and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. After having been repeatedly beaten and sexually assaulted during his first 13 months in jail, during which time he asked his father to pray for him that he would get out of prison alive, he hanged himself in his cell. From Georgia, there are reports of totally sadistic treatment of prisoners, men who had not violated any rules or even resisted their guards, handcuffed and having their faces and skulls crushed in against walls by prison officials. Do we plan to keep these people in jail forever? Or will we be dumping hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children onto our streets at the end of their prison sentences and then reap whatever havoc one might reasonably expect on the part of those who have been themselves so brutalized? A juvenile justice official from a southwestern state recently said to me, "If we're going to throw these kids in jail and treat them the way we're treating them now, then you better plan to keep them in jail for a very long time." If we do not change our direction drastically, then within 5 to 15 years, our cities will be like war zones. We will all be living in gated communities. We will shop only at private, guarded entertainment and shopping complexes. In other words, we will be in prison. But we will have plenty of military equipment to protect our precious way of life and plenty of toys to keep us happy. Don't worry about it. None of that will be endangered. Even worse, we will have done this to ourselves.